This is DW News live from Berlin. The US House Judiciary Committee votes to impeach President Trump and formally accuses him of abusing his power and obstructing Congress. This latest move against the president sets the stage for a historic vote in the House of Representatives, only the third in American history. Also on the program, Boris Johnson returns to Downing Street after securing a stunning victory in the British election, and his message for voters.
And we will work round the clock to repay your trust and to deliver on your priorities with a parliament that works for you.
Also, EU leaders agree a Green Deal to make Europe carbon neutral by 2050, but heavy coal user Poland gets an opt-out. And we get a first-hand account of life inside China's internment camps for its Uyghur minority. Inmates are punished for speaking their own language and subject to abuse and daily humiliation. I'm Phil Gale. Welcome to the programme. The US House Judiciary Committee has approved impeachment articles against President Trump, charging him with abuse of power and obstructing Congress. The committee voted along party lines, 23 Democrats in favour, 17 Republicans against. The House of Representatives is now expected to vote next week on whether to impeach the president on those two charges. The first, abuse of power, stems from a phone call where Mr. Trump is said to have pressured Ukraine's president to investigate Mr. Trump's political rival Joe Biden. Mr. Trump is also accused of withholding U.S. security aid to Ukraine for political reasons. The second charge alleges that the president attempted to block efforts to investigate his actions. President Trump denies any wrongdoing.
Mr. Jordan votes no.
Now, Mr. Trump has been quick to react to this decision at one point, threatening that any future Democratic president might face an impeachment process as revenge.
It's a scam. It's something that shouldn't be allowed. And it's a very bad thing for our country. And you're trivializing impeachment. And I tell you what, someday there'll be a Democrat president and there'll be a Republican House. And I suspect they're going to remember it.
Straight to Washington correspondent Oliver Sallet. Welcome, Oliver. The president there clearly in fighting mood. Does he acknowledge this as a grave situation?
All right, Phil, it really seemed like it. And he also seemed to be addressing his supporter base when he responded to this vote earlier today, not really trying to convince anyone on the other side of the political aisle. He also said, you just played a soundbite, and that it shouldn't be allowed that a president like him is going through such impeachment proceedings, so really taking on democracy in and of itself, and that shows that he does really understand it's a great situation, a grave situation he finds himself in, and also the fact that he stays on message. He's been calling this a political witch hunt since the proceedings began, and essentially the argument that the Republicans are trying to put forward here is that the Democrats cannot accept the fact that he won the 2016 election and that they believe the only chance to get rid of President Trump is to remove him in after an impeachment proceeding. That, however, is quite unlikely due to a Republican majority in Senate.
Okay, so given this grave situation, is there any way in which this impeachment might actually work in the president's favor?
Well, we are entering uncharted terrain, Phil, so it's hard to say because never before did an impeached president later run for re-election. So it will certainly be very interesting to see how that all will play out in President Trump's campaign. That's where the Democrats are putting their hopes in a shift in public opinion. But in the end, it all goes down to the Senate trial, and it depends how that will work out. Trump, by the way, wants a long trial. He wants the Bidens and the whistleblower to testify, and the Republicans really want to take advantage of that situation and turn the tide and in either way damage the case the Democrats are trying to make here.
All right, well, this is just the start of the start, as it were. Oliver Sallet in Washington, thank you. Now we'll take a look at some of the other stories making news around the world. Former Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu has launched a new party to rival longtime President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The new Future Party is one of two splinter groups to be founded by former Erdogan allies amid reports of discontent within the ruling AK party over the president's authoritarian style of government. In Algeria, former Prime Minister Abdelmadjid Tebboune has won the presidential election, according to the Electoral Commission. But turnout was low after the opposition called for a boycott. In some cities, protesters tried to disrupt voting. Algeria has been in political limbo for months since protests helped to oust its longtime president. Protests against India's new citizenship law have continued for a third day, with violent clashes now spreading to the capital, Delhi. Critics say the law does not extend the same protection to Muslim migrants as to other religious minorities. Now to Britain. They called it the Brexit election, and now British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's been given the green light to take the UK out of the European Union. Mr. Johnson's Conservatives took a landslide victory, bringing more than 3 years of deadlock and bitter wrangling to an end.
He's not only got an absolute parliamentary majority, now he also has the Queen's instruction to form a government. A warm welcome back in Downing Street. For him, the election result is a personal triumph. In the afternoon, he spoke.
Good afternoon. I frankly urge everyone on either side of what are, after 3 years, 3.5 years, after all, an increasingly arid argument, I urge everyone to find closure and to let the healing begin.
The bigger loser of the night, Jeremy Corbyn, who had been offering a second Brexit referendum. His Labour Party lost seats in central and northern England, which had been safe for decades. Many party colleagues harshly criticised their leader, saying his extreme left-wing policies scared off voters. He rejects that and says he'll stay in charge at least for the time being.
I was elected to lead the party, and I think the responsible thing to do is not to walk away from the whole thing, and I won't do that. I will stay here until there has been somebody elected to succeed me, and then I will step down at that point.
The SNP Scottish Nationalists made significant gains and now feel their demands for a referendum on Scottish independence have increased in strength. The question of uniting the kingdom has returned. After Brexit, this will be one of the biggest challenges for the Prime Minister.
John Worth is a journalist and anti-Brexit campaigner. Welcome, John. In the last few minutes, we've been seeing and hearing about scuffles breaking out in central London, activists out in force against the Tory win. It seems very un-British, but then the last 3 years have seemed very un-British.
That's true. And also, it happened after previous elections as well. There's this kind of boiling over of anger at that things kind of ended up going so badly. We see some pictures there now. It's quite difficult to tell at the moment exactly how many protesters there are. There are definitely a lot of police on the streets there. But we've seen similar sorts of things after previous Conservative election victories. I don't think we can ultimately read too much into this.
But what we can read into this election victory for the Tories is that this is a government committed to getting Brexit done in their term. So, as far as you as an anti-Brexit campaigner are concerned, is that the end of the road for you?
That's the end of the road for now. Boris Johnson will get his Brexit deal through by the 31st of January. And then some further problems will come. But Britain will already then be out. So then the question comes, what will the future relationship be between Britain and the EU? And what sort of trade deal will Britain be able to get? But ultimately, the question is essentially that's just kind of trying to make the best of a bad situation. I've long argued that it would have been a better route to try to keep Britain in through a second referendum. The way to that is now definitively blocked as a result of this election. And so I can't see any reasonable or sensible way out. So therefore, as I see it, the battle to stop Brexit happening was definitively lost in the early hours of this morning.
Because this is the thing, because there is a certain irony in you living in Germany and telling Britain that it should not be leaving the EU.
But I'm still a UK voter, right?
Absolutely.
And us Brits living overseas are very impacted by what happens, of course.
But given all of that, what we have is a situation where there was a referendum, a closely contested a vote, and now this being so soundly and definitive, especially given Britain's weird election rules, now that this decision has been made, why do you not accept that, regardless of what you see as the economic benefits or otherwise, why do you not accept that this is what Britain wants?
I don't actually think it is what Britain wants, because it was 44% of the vote, or maybe just over, that the Conservatives received. And because of the twisted British election system that you mentioned, that gave Boris Johnson 56% of the vote, of the seats in Parliament. And actually, if you look at the way that if you add the pro-Brexit parties together and you add the pro-Remain parties together, it actually came in at 52% for pro-Remain parties at this election. But the problem was is they weren't unified, and so therefore they took some of the seats off each other. So ultimately, also, sadly, and this is the regret in this whole thing, in the opinion polls conducted about Brexit before the election took place, 53 or 54% of the British population said they then actually now wanted to stay in the European Union. So I accept this result in as far as it means the fight has to stop. But I think it's a very unfortunate way to end all of this. And it's only because of Britain's twisted election system that Boris Johnson manages to have a majority. And he rather arrogantly, in my view, said that Britain is the best democracy in the world in his acceptance speech. Now, I don't really know how good a quality of democracy it is where 46% of the votes lead to 56% of the seats.
John Worth.
Thank you.
No, European leaders meeting in Brussels have broken a deadlock on a far-reaching green agenda to make the EU carbon neutral by 2050. Poland, which is heavily dependent on coal, refused to commit to the deal and wanted to push the deadline back to 2070. But other member states have pushed the agreement through, hailing it as a major step forward.
A council president in good spirits. Following a long day of debate, Charles Michel seemed relieved to have cleared the first obstacle of the EU's climate action plan.
I am pleased with this important agreement yesterday about climate change. It was very important for the European Union to decide and to have a common goal, climate neutrality by 2050, with a clear vision about the investments we have to develop and to encourage in the next years.
This summit is the first since the newly appointed Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, unveiled her European Green Deal, a master plan that might fundamentally transform the EU in the years to come. It includes a 50% reduction in EU carbon emissions in 2030, climate neutrality by 2050, a carbon border tax on polluting foreign firms, and a 100 billion euro transition fund for countries dependent on coal and nuclear energy. An ambitious plan. Von der Leyen will have to do some more convincing along the way. Finland, however, is already sold on the urgency of the matter.
We all know that we have to do more, we have to do it faster. It's about our children's future, it's about future generations. But I'm very happy about these steps forward that we made last night.
Last night, after 10 hours of debate, almost all member states endorsed the goal of the EU becoming climate neutral by 2050. But one country did not commit to actually implementing that goal, Poland. The reason for this exception is that Poland's energy largely comes from coal, and the country fears the costs of transition to a greener economy. Poland holding back might seem disappointing, but not to German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
I understand why he's asking for more time. And I'd like to say that if people pretend that the transition is just as difficult for those who rely 80% as for those who rely 65% on nuclear energy, that is not true.
The plan is on the table. Now it's up to the leaders to bring it to life in the next few months.
Tadja Müller is a senior advisor for climate justice at Germany's left-leaning Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. Welcome to DW.
Thank you for having me.
EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says that this deal represents Europe's man-on-the-moon moment. What do you think?
I think that's just silly. First of all, the Green Deal is, in essence, a growth programme. Now, growth got us into the problem of climate change, of the biodiversity crisis, and a growth programme won't get us out of it. And secondly, it just announces a set of targets. And I've been doing climate politics now for 12 years. Announcing targets does not mean they're actually going to be met. I mean, remember Paris set the target of 1.5 degrees shouldn't be passed? we're totally going to pass that. So targets don't solve the crisis.
So here's the thing, then. If not this, then, all right, because it must be surely significant that one of the biggest economic blocks in the world sets a target for carbon neutrality. You don't see that as significant.
2050 targets are irrelevant. That's what, 7, 8 legislative elections down the line. By that time, these folks who are now saying that we'll no longer be accountable. Greta Thunberg herself said what you announced as a 2050 target is totally silly. I could, and I said this a few days ago, I could say I'm going to have a family living on Mars by 2050 and nobody could call me out on it because it's way too far in the future and the climate crisis is now.
So, if not that, then what? What now?
What now? Europe is building massive amounts of fossil gas infrastructure, not just the Nord Stream pipeline. Around the continent, we're building massive sets of gas installations, fossil gas installations. That should stop. Europe should stop subsidizing fossil fuels.
Let me just stop you on those two, right?
By all means.
If Europe does that, if Europe just stops, what happens to the energy gap, if I can put it that way? The energy that these projects were being built in order to provide, where do we get that from?
So the question is, what do we need all that energy for? Have you been in an inner city at night? Is all that lighting necessary? Have you looked at the production facilities that are around, that exist around Europe? Are they all necessary?
Okay,
if we ask ourselves the question of the climate crisis, we have to ask ourselves what kind of lives do we want to lead?
Okay, and what I'm keen to get at is practicalities. So, Europe stops building these carbon-based
infrastructures,
and does what instead?
Well, get used to living a life that is slightly less materially opulent, but, in the words of the Google founders, doesn't do evil. Do we really want to be a global-scale Trump, where we're basically telling global poor people, you're screwed, we don't care about your lives? I don't personally think that that is the kind of life that Europeans want to lead. That is not the kind of Europe that Europeans want to see in the world. They actually want to see the climate leader, the justice leader, which Europe is by no means.
We must leave it there. Tadjo Muller, thank you so much.
Thank you.
More than 1 million ethnic Uyghur Muslims are being held in northwestern China. Beijing insists the internment camps are voluntary re-education centres. Leaked documents, known as the China Cables, tell a different story of mass surveillance and harsh treatment. Thousands of Uyghurs have fled into exile. DW correspondent Yulia Han met one woman who was trapped in a detention centre for more than a year.
Going for a walk with her grandson. Just a year ago, Gulbahar Jelilova wouldn't have dreamt it was possible. At the time, she was in China, in one of the internment camps for Uyghurs, or education centres, as the leadership in Beijing calls them.
This is from the day I was arrested. It states my name, my birth date, and that I am a terrorist.
Gulbahar says the Chinese authorities never explained why they thought she was a terrorist. She tells us about the cruel conditions in the camps, about torture and humiliation.
If you were caught speaking Uyghur, you were locked up in a dark room. We also had to write out lines of praise to the Chinese Communist Party. Every 10 days, we had to stick our arms through to get an injection. We didn't know what it was, but the younger women stopped having their periods. We had to do sit-ups in the nude. It didn't matter if you were 14 or 84. That's how they violated our honor.
Istanbul is home to around 25,000 Uyghurs. For example, the Zeytinburnu district. Like Gulbahar, many have found refuge here. Some even say that the capital of the Uyghurs is no longer in Xinjiang, but in Turkey. In primary school, the children of those who fled China. Singing, reading, writing in their mother tongue. The teachers here say in China that would be impossible.
Many Uyghurs say that ethnic and religious ties with Turkey have made building new lives here in Istanbul easier for them. At first glance, this neighborhood appears lively, bustling. But the community has an open secret. Almost everybody here, they say, has a relative or friend who has disappeared into one of the camps in China.
My brothers were imprisoned. My sister was sent to a camp. Did they get out? Are they dead or alive? I don't know.
I haven't had any contact with my family in 5 or 6 years, not even a phone call. I'm 99% sure that they're in the camps or in prison. I haven't heard from my family in 5 years.
Dozens of versions of the same story. For some, it's too painful to talk. China's ambassador to Turkey admits that some Uyghurs have trouble contacting their families. He says steps are being taken. But he rejects reports of human rights violations in Xinjiang.
The education centers are not prisons. They are not concentration camps, as some media reports say. In fact, these places are more like boarding schools, and the basic human rights of the students are respected. They can contact their families and receive visitors. I have the impression that some media and powers are abusing this subject to cast China's Xinjiang policy in a bad light.
Gulbahar Jelilova sees things very differently. She would like foreign countries to put more pressure on China. She says the horrors she experienced in the camps of Xinjiang have changed her. And she is speaking up in the hope that others are spared her fate.
Now, Uyghurs living in exile around the world say they have heard nothing from loved ones being held in those camps, despite China's insistence that they can contact their families. DW reporter Anthony Howard can tell us more. Welcome, Anthony. So, the Uyghur exiles have been posting about their plight online.
Especially since just a couple of days ago, the governor of the Xinjiang region said that everyone being held in these camps had been released. Now, he didn't refer to them as camps, he referred to them as vocational training centres, not camps, and said that all the people that were in these training centres, as he called them, had graduated and were living happy lives, he said. Now, that statement has been greeted with disbelief from Uyghurs or family members who are living in other parts of the world and have not heard from family members in mainland China for some 2 years. In many cases, they've not heard anything. So some of them, a Uyghur living in the US, one of them particularly, Bahram Sintash, started a social media campaign using the hashtag #StillNoInfo. He said he wanted to, and I'd use a direct quote, condemn China's lie that those in the camps have now graduated. Now, Uyghurs around the world right now are using that hashtag, #StillNoInfo, to share their stories of those who remain missing despite China's claim to the contrary. It's worth just underlining, Phil, what the Chinese say and what the relatives of the disappeared say are almost completely, some would say desperately, at odds. So the relatives turn to each other in lieu of anything more concrete insofar as information is concerned.
Seems like a weird lie to tell when there are hundreds of thousands of people around the world who just turn around and say, no, that's just rubbish. Right. DW has been talking to a Uyghur man using this hashtag. What have we heard?
Spoke to today, Abdallah Toti Arish, who's been granted asylum here in Germany. He's living in the southwest in Stuttgart. He's come from Xinjiang, or East Turkestan, as he calls it. He's a separatist and doesn't recognise China's control of the region. He told us that his brother, a computer scientist, and his father-in-law, a well-respected businessman, have been detained in camps since 2017. Now, the family does not know why they were detained, and he's heard nothing of them since. They don't even know whether or not they are dead or alive. Abdallah says the Uyghurs are faced behind bars, a stark choice, whether they give up their Uyghur identity and become Han Chinese, or whether they stay in these camps forever. He also rejects the Chinese argument that these camps are needed to combat terrorism, saying that whether or not you use the United Nations estimation of 1 million people behind bars or 3 million, where the US Defense Department are, they couldn't possibly all be terrorists. And another underlying reason why these family members must turn to social media for any sense of support in lieu of anything more concrete.
OK. Concerning story there. Anthony, thank you so much. Anthony Howard. Football now. Liverpool coach Jurgen Klopp's extended his contract with the club until 2024. He took over 4 years ago after seven seasons at Borussia Dortmund and guided the Reds to the Champions League last season. Liverpool haven't won an English title in 30 years, but this campaign, the club is hoping that Klopp can keep them at the top until the end of the season.
We will see what happens. So the plan is to make it the best time of our life. It was not too bad until now, but we don't have the feeling that it could not be even better. So let's try to make really the best time of our lives of it, and enjoy the ride, enjoy the journey.
This is DW News. These are our top stories. The US House Judiciary Committee has approved impeachment articles against President Donald Trump that charge him with abuse of power and obstructing Congress. The House of Representatives is now expected to vote next week on whether to impeach the president on the two charges. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson says his government has been given a powerful new mandate to finally take the UK out of the European Union. And Mr. Johnson's Conservative Party won an overall majority in the country's general election, decisively ending 3.5 years of political gridlock. It's a historic defeat for the opposition Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, which lost seats in many of its traditional strongholds. Thank you, Madam. The UN climate summit in Madrid is to be extended. The conference was due to conclude today, but with disagreement among participants, and negotiations are set to drag on. Representatives of nearly 200 states have been trying to find solutions to the climate crisis ahead of crucial 2020 deadlines as set by the Paris Agreement. This is DW News from Berlin. For more, follow us on Twitter at DW News or visit our website, dw.com. Up next here on DW, Eco Africa, our environment magazine, is on. Don't forget, you can get all the latest news and information around the clock on that website at dw.com. I'll be back at the top of the hour. Have a good day.
Africa. Plenty of garbage and not many construction materials in Kenya. What to do? Use the garbage, like old bottles, to build things.
This is the school now. All the bottles are here.
A simple solution for a serious problem.
Eco Africa. Next on DW.
Data, AR, IoT, robotics, ML, deep learning, merged reality.
Wait a second. Do you want the whole picture? Hard facts instead of vague ideas? Shift delivers. From augmented reality to cryptocurrency, your topics for live in an ever-changing digital world. Let's talk digitalization.
Shift. On DW. It was the speech of his life.
perhaps his best, certainly his most difficult. The speech by Helmut Kohl in Dresden on December 19, 1989. Shortly after the fall of the wall, the Chancellor addresses the people of East Germany. The mood is tense. The crowd clamors for German unity. Journalist Peter Limburg was at the scene. 30 years later, he looks back on the Tightrope Act in Dresden. Starts December 19th on DW.